In the name of God, most gracious, most compassionate. Good evening. Thanks for coming here tonight. As Nima pointed out, the topic of tonight's presentation is Islam, faith and tradition. My primary motivation for choosing this specific topic for tonight is that hopefully I will be able to dispel some common myths and misconceptions about Islam. There is so much bad information floating around on the internet and in our media that every time I talk about subjects such as tonight's presentation, I feel like a lot more still needs to be done. Unfortunately, some folks on the far right in this country have a political agenda in spreading half-truths and full lies about Islam and Muslims. And I specifically mean the neoconservatives and the activists in the so-called anti-Sharia movement. They commonly engage in politics of fear. They're hoping that a frightened American public will view them as saviors and vote them into public office. The question is, how do they play this fear card? Well, they pretend that there is an imminent danger of a Muslim takeover of America, that Muslims are here to take over the U.S., abolish the Constitution, and replace it with Sharia or the Islamic law. Now, most of the misconceptions about Islam revolve around some social customs, some cultural practices and legal codes that are incorrectly attributed to Islam. And I will give you a lot of examples tonight about those specific cases. The primary message of this presentation tonight is this. We should make a distinction between Islam as a system of faith and local social customs, local cultural practices that some Muslims around the world may engage in. So not everything that Muslims around the world do in Iran, Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, so on and so forth, those do not necessarily mean though they are Islamic practices. So that's going to be the main message of my presentation tonight. It probably is a good idea for me to spend a few minutes and talk about a universal pattern in the development of world religions. And this pattern you can find in the development of Christianity, Islam, and basically any authentically world religion. With respect to Islam, this is the way this pattern evolved over time. After the death of the Prophet Muhammad, Islam left its birthplace, Arabia, and started expanding in all four directions. Islam found new converts in different parts of the globe. People from different cultures, ethnicities, and races basically converted over to Islam. So in short order, the rank and file of Islam grew very rapidly. In fact, in the history of world religions, no religion expanded so rapidly at that rapid pace as Islam did. In less than a generation, Islam pretty much was present and had taken over all the major civilizations of the time. Now, this rapid expansion of Islam had some negative consequences for the future of Islam. And this is the critical point. So this rapid expansion to some Muslims is a good thing. But I'm here to argue that, in fact, there were some negative consequences associated with the rapid expansion of Islam. I'm going to just point out two of those consequences. The first consequences is what I would call absorption. Like a sponge, Islam started absorbing some alien cultural practices. It started absorbing some alien social customs. As Islam entered new lands, it adapted itself to local cultures and local civilizations. Persians, Egyptians, Byzantines, and later on East Asians, they all interacted with Islam. This interaction between Islam and the newcomers obviously was a two-way street. On the one hand, Islam definitely impacted the new converts, the new land it entered. But on the other hand, the local cultures, as I mentioned, also impacted Islam, and in the process, a new phenomenon emerged. What is that? That's what we call, quote-unquote, Islamic culture. This Islamic culture did not exist at the time of the Prophet Muhammad. This is absolutely crucial for tonight's presentation. This culture evolved over time, and little by little, social customs, cultural practices of these nations were accumulated, and this phenomenon was created. In the beginning, we only had a religion called Islam, which was synonymous with its holy scripture, the Quran. At the time of the Prophet Muhammad, Islam was the Quran. Nothing more, nothing less. But in the process of expansion, every new community that converted to Islam brought with it some new elements of their local customs and cultural practices into the larger Islamic community. Now, do you know what this process led to? Well, future generations of Muslims would be hard-pressed to differentiate between Islam as a faith and these customs and cultural practices that had entered into the fold of Islam. They would have such a hard time making that distinction, and that problem exists until today. Even people who consider themselves very good, faithful Muslims, I see them all the time, they cling on to some customs, traditions that are not Islamic. So nothing to do with Islam. They are confusing Islam as a system of faith and these local cultural practices. So this is the first negative consequence of the Islamic expansion, and I will elaborate more on this shortly. The second consequence of the expansion of Islam was adaptation to the requirements of power. Let me repeat. Islam started to adapt itself to the requirements of power. You see, as Islam expanded into new territories, naturally the number of its followers and adherents grew exponentially. Greater numbers always mean greater power. Greater numbers mean greater social strength. So, gradually, Islam became a significant player on the political scene. Islam became a significant political factor. Islam rapidly entered the halls of power. Christianity had the same experience centuries ago. So, when Islam entered the halls of power, it effectively became part of the political structure. So suddenly we had elaborate and huge empires, what we call the caliphate or khilafat, like the Abbasid or the Umayyad or the Ottoman empires all over the globe. Suddenly we had systems of power, states that all carried the label Islamic. I will come back to this later on. All these government structures, states, they all called themselves Islamic. Now, this development had both positive and negative consequences for people, the fact that Islam entered the halls of power. On the upside, definitely Islam introduced a new element to the politics of most nations. You know what that new element was? A rule of law. This is well documented. Islam introduced the rule of law to some political systems and that were basically lawless. Law was the king. Whatever the king said was the law of the land. So Islam definitely changed that picture. And also Islam demanded greater fairness and justice from kings toward their subjects. So this was a good development. But on the negative side, what happened is that Islam, just like Christianity centuries before, had to bow to requirements of power. You see, every time you get involved in politics, it's a two-way street. You will impact and will be impacted by this interaction. It's a two-way street. Soon, Islam became an instrument in the service of political power. Islam became a means in the hands of kings to achieve political ends. Now, if you want to visualize this process, just look at the contemporary political system in Iran and observe how they use, or I should better say, abuse Islam to justify horrible policies and practices that they have. So this is the negative consequence of Islam entering the halls of power. In the end, caliphs, emirs, and sultans hired Muslim jurists to issue rulings that by and large served their interest. Much of these rulings, and this is very critical for understanding what happened to Islam. Most of these rulings issued by fuqaha or jurists served the interests of the powerful. Much of their rulings were oppressive and discriminatory, and unfortunately, we as Muslims inherited those discriminatory and oppressive rulings. In time, these rulings, these legal codes, ended up being called Islamic. These rulings became, quote-unquote, Islamic law, even though original Islam had absolutely nothing to do with them. Islam had nothing to do with these rulings. They were basically later inventions. Almost all of what we know today as Islamic law or Sharia is basically the product of the expansionary period of Islam. In a nutshell, today we are confronted with a large body of social customs, cultural practices, and legal codes that were accumulated over centuries. And the general public perceives these as Islamic. That's what the general perception, both amongst Muslims and non-Muslims, is. Now, enough for theory. Let me give you some concrete examples of some social customs and legal codes that are today viewed as Islamic, but original Islam has absolutely nothing to do with them. You hear and read about these practices all the time on the internet and in the media. There are just so many examples I could use. The ones that I will offer you tonight are the ones that are more referred to in the American media. I'm sure as I go through these examples, you can creatively come up with other examples in your mind, and definitely we can talk about them in the Q&A session. The first example of a social custom that is wrongly attributed to Islam is the preferential treatment of boys and girls in many Muslim societies. Most Muslim nations, such as Iran, are a lot more laxed and forgiving when it comes to boys than girls. I guess especially those of you who come from Iran or Afghanistan know exactly what I'm talking about. Often it is okay for a boy to have sex before marriage, but it is absolutely wrong for a girl to do so. Virginity exclusively applies to girls. Am I right on that or not? That's what you find in most families across the Middle East, if you go around. Now, on the surface, it looks like this is an Islamic teaching. Muslims do it, then therefore it has to have some basis in Islam. But in fact, this is a cultural bias, not a product of Islam. Naturally, in male-dominated societies, males are the favorite. The society is a lot more forgiving about males than females. That's exactly what we expect. Now, the thing is, as I mentioned, this is a social custom. It has nothing to do with Islam. In those countries, even non-Muslims, let's say Christians, Zoroastrians, or even non-religious people at all, have exactly the same attitude towards their boys and girls. Original Islam is the Quran, right? So anytime tonight I talk about original Islam, I mean the Quran. Now, the Quran does not prefer males over females. As far as God is concerned, both men and women should keep to the same rigorous high standards, both of them. Let me give you an example from the Holy Quran, chapter 24, verses 30 and 31. I think these verses are just so manifest and evident in what I just shared with you. Prophet, tell believing men to lower their gaze and not stare at women, and to maintain their chastity. This is purer for them. And tell believing women to lower their gaze and maintain their chastity. Now, in male-dominated Muslim nations, they forget about the first part of the verse and they only concentrate on the second part. Whereas Islam does not discriminate between men and women in this regard. Both must practice chastity. They both have to live by exactly the same standards. So this is the first example of a cultural bias that you see in the Islamic world, so-called Islamic world, and it absolutely has no basis in the original religion of Islam. The second example is separation of sexes. This is very eye-opening. If you visit countries like Saudi Arabia, Iran, or Afghanistan, especially under the Taliban, you will find that men and women are pretty much segregated in public places, in mosques, in schools, sometimes even in government offices. They are definitely segregated. An outsider's first impression, again, would be, well, seclusion is an Islamic mandate. Seclusion of sexes is an Islamic requirement. And probably some of you in the audience would say, yeah, it is a requirement. Well, if you go to Mecca, and I know that Kamal was there recently, if you go to Mecca and visit Islam's holiest site, the Kaaba, you will witness an amazing scene. You will find men and women we do tawaf, or the circular walk around Kaaba, side by side. Men and women in Islam's holiest site worship and pray together. My wife would be in front of me, I will be behind her when I pray. It is unthinkable to do it in your mosque here. No one dares doing that. No one dares doing that. I apologize if I insult some of your sensibilities, but it is true. Have you ever thought about that? Why is it that in Islam's holiest place, there is no separation of sexes, but if you go to the shrine of Imam Rizal, for example, definitely they are separated. Why? Why is it that in Islam's holiest site, there is no seclusion of sexes, but you see it everywhere else, in mosques? Why? Now, you see this scene in Kaaba, leave Kaaba and go to a local Burger King restaurant. In there you will see complete segregation of sexes. Apparently it's okay for men and women to mingle in Kaaba, but not in Burger King. Now, at the time of the Prophet Muhammad, separating the sexes was a non-issue. It was not an issue at all. That's why you do not find any references to it in the Holy Quran. Cover to cover, if you read the Quran, separating sexes is not a mandate. It is not a requirement. Seclusion of sexes, however, was predominant, prevalent in times long gone by. For example, in the Byzantine Empire, it was an acceptable practice. And according to some accounts, even in the Persian Empire, in some segments of society, you would see separation of sexes. During the expansion of Islam into these lands, Muslims started adopting these social customs, these cultural practices, and unfortunately in due time, this particular practice, seclusion of sexes, became labeled as an Islamic practice. Well, now that you know the discussion is getting hot, let me give you another one. Women's dress code. If you visit Saudi Arabia or Afghanistan, you will notice that a lot of women cover their faces. Even when they migrate, they immigrate to the US and Europe, they still do that. You know, I live in San Diego, and sometimes I'm having dinner in downtown San Diego, and I do see women pretty much with their faces covered. If you go to Iran, you will find women wearing the so-called chador, which is a garb covering head to toe. If you ask a mullah in Iran, he would tell you that this is the appropriate dress code for a woman. When in fact, this is an absolutely false statement. There is nothing Islamic about chador. There is nothing Islamic about covering women's faces. You do not find any reference to that in the Holy Quran. Again, chador is definitely an Iranian traditional dress for women. I'm not saying it's bad. It is a traditional dress, and we need to view it like that. We should not call that the Islamic dress code for women. Let me talk about a couple other social customs that are outright horrible, and you do hear about them in our media a lot, and I would definitely like to address them. The first one is honor killing. There is a perception in the US media that honor killing is an Islamic practice. It is often said that Islam condones this horrible practice because some Muslims around the world engage in it. Well, if a Muslim does it, it must be kosher in Islam, right? Wrong. There are a lot of things that Muslims do around the world that are actually contrary to original Islam. For those of you who are not familiar with this practice of honor killing, let me give you a very, you know, a two-minute introduction to it. Honor killing is basically the killing of a family member or the killing of a member of a social group because it is believed that the victim has brought shame and dishonor on the family or the community. For example, when a person has sex outside marriage, or when the woman basically gets out of a pre-arranged marriage or wants to marry by choice. Now, honor killing is mostly directed at women and girls. The United Nations estimates that every year about 5,000 women and girls are killed by members of their own families because of this practice. Interestingly enough, honor killing is practiced by members of different religious communities. So it's not specific to a given religious community. People from different religious backgrounds engage in it. For example, you can find honor killing take place in Muslim Pakistan as well as Hindu India. In the Middle East, some Christian communities engage in it. Even the Middle Eastern and North African immigrants to North America and Europe engage in it. So it's a widespread practice. The bottom line is this: honor killing is purely a social custom. It has no basis in any world religion. It's a social custom. It's not definitely an Islamic teaching. It is not condoned by Islam. This is just another example of a local social custom that has been incorrectly branded as Islamic. The next example that I would like to share with you, and you find this mentioned in our media a lot, is female circumcision. Female circumcision. This is another horrible act that apparently Westerners and Americans first saw it in some Muslim immigrant communities from North Africa. So the first time they saw this practice was when they saw immigrants from North Africa, and they concluded that because Muslims do it, it must have some basis in Islam. A bit of background about female circumcision. This practice, female circumcision, is an operation to deprive a woman from having sexual pleasure. Its origin is unknown. We don't know who started that. But historians trace it back to at least the 2nd century BC. And apparently there is evidence that female circumcision was practiced by tribes on the western shore of the Red Sea, which is today's Egypt. Now, some religious communities circumcise females. Why? Because they view it as a way to control their sexuality. They view it as a mechanism to discourage females from having premarital sex. And after they get married, it ensures them that there is less of a chance that they would have sex outside marriage. Those of you who've studied a bit of sociology understand why there is this practice. It has to do with the notion that wives are the private properties of their husbands, basically. Pretty much the husband can do whatever he damn pleases with the woman. Female circumcision still takes place in Africa and the Middle East. However, it is strictly a cultural practice. It has no basis in any religion. People from different religious backgrounds commit female circumcision. For example, in Egypt, sometimes Coptic Christians circumcise their girls. In Tanzania, in fact, regions that are predominantly Christians have the highest percentage of female circumcision. These Christians do this horrible act not because Christianity condones it. They do it not because it is something that Christianity favors. They do it because it is their local custom. It's a cultural practice. Same goes for the Muslims. Let me repeat. Female circumcision is a non-issue in the Quran. Meaning what? There is not a single verse that deals with this issue in the Quran. Not in support of it, not in opposition to it, because it is a non-issue. The next example I would like to share with you has to do with some penal codes that are perceived to be Islamic. Again, they are talked about in our media a lot. Over the centuries, Muslim jurists in different nations came up with schools of jurisprudence. By the way, for those of you who don't know what jurisprudence is, in Arabic and Farsi, we call it fiqh, schools of fiqh. These different schools of fiqh, like Shafi'i, Maliki, Hanbali, or the Shi'i, none of them existed at the time of the Prophet Muhammad. We didn't have anything called fiqh during the time of the Prophet Muhammad. They were later inventions. They were later creations. So Muslim jurists started creating these schools of thought and these schools of jurisprudence in order to enact religious law. This is what we call Sharia, by the way. There are a few laws in Sharia that attract quite a lot of negative publicity in our media these days. The first one is stoning as a punishment for adultery. The second controversial practice is death for heresy. In other words, let's say a Muslim converts into Christianity, and then according to most Muslim jurists, the punishment for that person is death. Death for heresy and stoning as a punishment for adultery. Neither of these are Islamically sanctioned. You do not find any reference for them in the Holy Quran, which is the authentic source to learn about Islam. There is no reference to these two punishments in the Quran. The Quran, when it comes to adultery, what is the punishment for adultery in the Holy Quran? Let me test your knowledge of the Quran. What is the punishment for adultery in the Quran? Lashes. That's still harsh, isn't it? However, the standards for proof is extremely high. What is the requirement to punish somebody for adultery? Four witnesses. That's pretty tough. It is next to impossible to catch somebody during the act of adultery when people are watching. But the whole idea behind this punishment is to make a statement. It is really a horrible thing in the sight of God. Don't do it. That is the whole reason for it. But stoning as a punishment for adultery, you do not find any reference for it in the Quran. Muslim jurists who prescribe this punishment actually get their inspirations not from the Quran, but from the Old Testament. It is a Jewish practice, but somehow found its way into the fold of Islam. As for heresy, there is absolutely no punishment for heresy in the Quran, is it? Has anybody found a punishment, even a slap in the face? Even an insult? None whatsoever. You do not find any kind of punishment, any kind of earthly punishment for heresy in the Holy Quran. Let me make a general point about the so-called Islamic law or Sharia, which is very important. There are actually, if you read the Quran cover to cover, you will find very few verses that deal with criminal law. Those of you who are familiar with the Quran, you can't find more than a dozen verses that deal with what we truly call criminal law these days. The bulk of Sharia is actually based on rulings of jurists of the past. It is not uncommon to find contradictory rulings on the same issue. That's the state of Muslim Sharia. Let me be very blunt here. What is known as Islamic law or Sharia are not words of God. They are opinions of men. It doesn't mean that they're necessarily bad. It doesn't mean that those rulings are inappropriate. All it means is that they are not divine. They are not sacred. You can critique them. You can reevaluate them. You can even reject them without rejecting your faith, which is Islam, right? I'm going to give you one more example again, because that's even so confusing for the average Muslim on the street. And that's the issue of authoritarianism. Unfortunately, most Muslims are convinced today that the best form of government is dictatorship. You will find a lot of Muslims in the US, I find it in my lectures all the time, every time I talk about democracy, every time I talk about liberty and freedom, invariably some Muslims get upset. They say, boy, look what freedom does. Look at the US. Look at all the horrible things that happen in this country. That's the result of freedom. So subconsciously, it seems like many of us are pre-wired. We are conditioned into thinking that liberty is bad. When people are free, they're going to do awful things. So we better have a big brother or, you know, a heavenly figure sit on top of our state and make sure that we behave correctly. So let me delve into it. Many pundits and even scholars in the West contend that Islam is inherently anti-democratic, that Islam cannot accept separation of religion from the state, that Islam cannot adopt modern forms of government that are based on popular will. Well, they point to, for example, the current government in Iran to support their case. What sort of government do we have in Iran? Well, we have a system of government that is called, in Farsi, Balayat-e-Faqih, or in English, a rule of jurists. Well, rule of jurists is a system of government where a Shi'i clergyman heads the state affairs, and pretty much that's where the buck stops. Whatever he says is effectively the law of the land. Even if you have presidency, as we have in Iran, presidency, for all intent and purposes, is a formality. Because the jurist, or Wali-e-Faqih, at any moment can pretty much strike down whatever the parliament has enacted or whatever the government has decided to do. All policies are up in the air if the jurist deems unnecessary. The Taliban, for example, in Afghanistan, they favor another form of government called caliphate, right? Both rule of jurist and caliphate, they are theocracies. And yes, they are both authoritarian and tyrannical. They both completely disregard modern conventions on human rights. However, both the Taliban and the ruling mullahs in Iran contend that their system of government is the authentic form of Islamic government. To them, that's the authentic form of Islamic government. Let me make a couple of points in response to this claim that, you know, caliphate or rule of jurist is the authentic form of Islamic government. First, yes, it is true that the Islamic world as a whole suffers from authoritarianism and tyranny. I'm the first one to admit that. However, this is due to the prevalence of a culture that promotes authoritarianism across most of the Middle East, across much of the Islamic world. We have a phenomenon called the authoritarian culture. Authoritarianism permeates the culture of those nations. You can find traces of authoritarianism in marital relationships, in child rearing, in business enterprises, and yes, in halls of government. It is definitely a cultural issue. It has nothing to do with Islam as a system of faith. In the Middle East and North Africa, you will find that both Muslim and non-Muslim political groups, both Muslims and secular folks, they are authoritarian when they come to power. Let me give you some examples. Iran under the ex-Shah, Egypt under Hosni Mubarak, Libya under Muammar Gaddafi, Iraq under Saddam Hussein, they were all authoritarian. They were all tyrannies, but they were also secular. They were not religious by any stretch of imagination. So my point is this. The reason we have authoritarian governments across the so-called Muslim world, it has to do with an authoritarian culture that breeds tyranny into the core and the fabric of the society. It has nothing to do with Islam. It is not a product of Islam. Authoritarianism definitely runs deep in those cultures. And obviously you see it in politics as well. The second point I want to make is this. That despite the claims of Iran's ruling clergymen, despite the claims of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, Islam does not have a form of government. Islam does not have a form of government. If you read the Quran, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with it, you will find clear commandments, clear teachings for daily prayers, salat. You will find clear commandments for ablution or wudu, clear commandments for pilgrimage, clear teachings about ethics and conception of God. But when it comes to government or political structure, the Quran is amazingly silent. The Quran is silent. Why? Did God forget to include government in Islam's holy book? Not at all. God didn't forget that. It's just that government has always been and will always be a civic institution. It is a secular institution. It is not a religious institution. Government can never, ever become religious. You can never, ever have an Islamic state. Let me even be more blunt than that. Even if the Prophet Muhammad or Imam Ali were at the head of a state, that state still would not be called Islamic. See, the state, by definition, is always a secular institution. Yes, you can have a Muslim-dominated government, but that is not the equivalent of an Islamic state. Do you see the difference between the two? Now, Muslims, during every historical era, must adopt a form of government that can best serve justice. Whatever form of government in a given historical era is most efficient, can safeguard Islamic social values such as justice, egalitarianism, the rule of law. Any form of government that can safeguard people's dignity and welfare, that is the best form of government that they should adopt in that time. In my opinion today, the best form of government is democracy for Muslims. Even though Islam did not invent political democracy. Islam didn't do it. But we as Muslims can adopt it. That's the message that I have for you tonight. Now, a rule of jurist and caliphate are not authentic Islamic forms of government, as I said, because Islam doesn't have one. Those two types of government formation are nothing but adoption of pre-existing forms of government. Did you know that? Rule of jurist or velayat faqih has no basis in Islam whatsoever. Do you know where it came from? Let me ask you this question. Those of you who have studied political theory, do you know where rule of jurist came from? It came from Plato's Republic. If you read Plato, what is his favorite form of government? Philosopher king. According to Plato, the best form of government is a government that is headed by a philosopher, a person who is full of wisdom. That king, who happens to also be a philosopher, knows best what is needed for people to be happy. So, in essence, you have a benevolent dictator. A benevolent dictator. So, Shi'i clergymen basically read Plato and said, boy, what a great idea. Except, we do not like philosophers. We like the theory of benevolent dictatorship, but we don't like philosophers. So what do? We're going to take philosopher king and translate it somehow into jurist king. That's what exactly they did. It was an exact photocopy of Plato's Republic. Now, how about the caliphate? I know that some of you said, well, that's Islamic. It had nothing to do with Islam. Caliphate was basically based on primitive tribal political formation in Arabia. Arabia at the time was a tribal society, and to a great extent, still today, Saudi Arabia is a tribal society. That notion existed at that time. Muslims didn't know any better. They adopted it. Later, they augmented caliphate with bureaucratic structures. Guess what? From the Persian Empire. In Khilafat Abbasi, or the Abbasid Caliphate, most of the bureaucrats, by the way, were Iranians. Did you know that? They were not Arabs, they were Iranians. Why? Because Arabs had no clue how to run a massive state apparatus. Iranians knew, Persians knew. So basically, the state apparatus was run mostly by Persians. So, to make a long story short, neither the caliphate that Al-Qaeda and Taliban favors, nor rule of jurist that Shi'i clergymen favor, neither of them is the authentic Islamic form of government, because Islam does not have one. Muslims are free to choose whatever form of government that serves Islam's social values. Enough for examples. I'm sure you can come up with even better examples. The ones that I shared with you tonight were the ones that you see in our media all the time, and I wanted to take a few minutes and address them. I guess all these examples show how cluttered the picture is if you want to identify original Islam. Well, it gets even messier than that if you introduce Sunnah. What is Sunnah? It's the massive body of sayings attributed to the Prophet Muhammad, and most of them are fabricated. Muslims, nonetheless, many of them believe that those belong to original Islam. Most of them are fabricated. Now, if you take these social customs, legal codes that have no basis in Islam, and add to it what we call sunnah, the picture will absolutely be very cluttered to identify what original Islam is. You see, we Muslims in the 21st century are at a distinct disadvantage relative to our counterparts in the early period of Islam, because we come into contact with an Islam that has gone through 1400 years of collecting all sorts of embellishment. 1400 years of dust has collected on Islam. 1400 years of embellishment. I think the famous Iranian poet Nizami Ganjavi has captured our predicament in a poem addressed to the Prophet Muhammad. I will share two verses of that poem with you, which I think is so eloquent, and it really tells you what we are up against. دین تو را در پی آرایشند، در پی آرایش و پیرایشند، بس که ببستند برو برگساز، گر تو بیایی نشناسیش باز. They are after embellishing your religion, decorating and dressing it up. They have put so much ornament on your religion that if you come back today, you would not be able to recognize it. Amen. If the Prophet Muhammad would come back today and go to Islam's holiest cities, go to Mecca, go to Medina, go to Karbala, go to Qom, he probably would not recognize that this is the religion he brought for humanity. That's our predicament. 1400 years of embellishment and dress up. Now, our challenge today is somehow to separate original Islam, pure and uncluttered, from the embellishments that it has received over the centuries. Brothers and sisters, it ain't gonna be easy. It's not going to be easy to be able to make that distinction. In fact, we have currently a movement underway in the Islamic world whose primary goal is to do away with the embellishments. Do you know what we call that movement? Islamic Reformation. There is a reform movement going on inside Islam today that I am a member of, which, by the way, I'm a member of that movement myself. The primary goal of that movement is to declutter Islam, to basically restore Islam to its original shape and form, to make Islam again empowering and inspiring for this generation. Now, let me make it very clear. The point of Islamic Reformation is not to create a new religion. It's not even to create a scaled-down version of Islam, because we are constantly criticized that, oh, you guys are trying to create a new religion. No, we are not trying to create a new religion. We are trying to declutter. We are trying to take the embellishments away and restore Islam to it, to what it used to be, which is nothing but the Holy Quran. Let me be very blunt here. Islam as it is preached in the US today, in mosques, Islamic centers, and so forth, has a very thick Middle Eastern accent. Islam, let me repeat, Islam as it is preached in our mosques, in our Islamic centers, in the US today, has a very thick Middle Eastern accent. That's why our youth are turned off by it, because they cannot relate to it. Our youth are products of a modern culture. They cannot relate to a Middle Eastern culture that is truly alien for them. I'm not saying that the Middle Eastern culture is bad. I was born and raised in it. All I'm saying is that that culture is not sacred. That culture is not divine. Right? So our task today is to make Islam meaningful to our youth in this culture. And Islam, the way it is preached in our mosques today, in my opinion, would not allow that. Unless and until they can relate to Islam in a meaningful way, they cannot live it. They cannot be inspired by it. Islam, like any authentic religion, is essentially about faith. Islam as faith is an ageless and timeless path for a spiritual journey which is open to every single one of us today. Islam as a system of faith is not bound to any culture. It is not bound to any geography. Faith, according to Islam, is all about surrender. Surrendering not to jurists, not to theologians, but to God and God only. This surrender must happen inside us, deep inside us. And when it happens, when we surrender to God, our center of gravity shifts. In other words, a self-centered lifestyle gives way to a God-centered lifestyle. This is the message of Islam as a system of faith. That's what we need to be practicing and focusing on in the 20th century. Now, when our center of gravity shifts, when self-centeredness gives way to God-centeredness, a massive transformation will take place in us. What is the nature of this transformation? Basically, the darkness we experience in our lives, according to the Quran, suddenly will turn into light. Our fears, our anxieties, according to the Quran, will give way to peace and serenity. Our constant friction with everybody in our environment, with our spouses, children, neighbors, all those frictions will give way to harmony. This is the magic of faith that Islam inspires us to embrace. That will lead to happiness. Brothers and sisters, happiness in this life, not in the afterlife. Unfortunately, many of us are wrongly taught to believe that happiness and joy is not attainable in this life. We have to wait for the afterlife to be existentially and deeply happy. And I'm here to tell you, Islam teaches us that if we have true faith, which means surrendering to God, changing our lifestyle, we can be happy and joyful in this life on earth. Islam as a system of faith does not belong to any geography. It does not belong to any specific culture. The American culture has the same distance to Islam as the Iranian culture. Let me repeat one more time. I know that it's controversial. The American culture, the French culture, have exactly the same distance to original Islam as the Saudi Arabian culture. Islam is not bound to a geography. It is not bound to any culture. Islam's homeland is as much Los Angeles as Mecca. Contrary to what we are taught, Islam does not have a homeland. If it did, it would not be a world religion, right? It would be the religion of that land only and only. In order for Islam to be a world religion, we must accept the fact that Islam does not have a homeland. Islam as a system of faith is as practical in a complex postmodern metropolitan setting as the tribal society of Arabia 1400 years ago, provided that it is decluttered. A cluttered Islam is not going to be practical in the 21st century. I'm the first one to admit it. But if we declutter Islam, if we restore Islam to its original form as a system of faith, then it will be very practical in metropolitan areas today. So, if you feel that your religion boxes you in, if you feel that you are boxed in, if you feel that the religion you have been taught is limiting you, that it is impeding you from soaring and flying, it is very likely that what you are adhering to is dogma and formalities and not faith. Brothers and sisters, faith is not restrictive. Faith is not going to choke you. Faith is not going to drag you down. Faith is to enable you to fly. Faith is about inspiration and empowerment. That is the message of Islam. In a sense, faith is love. It awakens, it inspires, and it empowers. Well, let me close with this verse from the Holy Quran that is a call to faith. That was the topic of the lecture tonight. We need to cling on Islam as a system of faith, not to cultural practices that are sold to us as Islamic, when in fact they have nothing to do with Islam. This verse in the Holy Quran really touches the core of my existence. You can even find it on my website in my banner. Rabbana, إننا سمعنا مناديا ينادي للإيمان أن آمنوا بربكم فآمنا. Our Lord, we have heard someone calling us to faith. Our Lord, we have heard someone calling us to faith. Believe in your Lord, and we have believed. Thank you very much for your attention, and God bless you all. Thank you.